offer you a reflection. You know, there's certain things that we just try to cover during the course of a year to stay in touch with certain elements of the spirituality of St. Benedict, and also especially because, you know, there are new people coming in at various times, and some of you that maybe haven't, you know, received information on different parts of St. Benedict's teaching. So in a certain sense, the presentation I'm going to give this morning, it can be looked upon as a review or an overview, depending on how much of it seems to be a review to you. I admit that some of what I'm going to talk about this morning it was included in the talk that I gave about 2.5 years ago in the fall of 2006. The talks on the spirituality of St. Benedict that we advertised and we held upstairs there in the chapel. But that's 2.5 years ago. Many of you were not here, and those of you that were, you hopefully won't have absorbed every single word that I said, so it'll be hopefully at least seem a little bit new and fresh. So this is going to be an overview, really, of the life of St. Benedict and his teaching in the rule. I could probably talk the rest of the week on this, so obviously it's going to be fairly abbreviated as such. And I want to just begin with speaking, reminding ourselves about the life of St. Benedict and, you know, his basic historical facts of his life. St. Benedict, as you know, was born in Italy. And he came from a region of Italy called Nursia, which is not too far from Rome, about 75 miles from Rome. He was born near the end of the 5th century, we think around 480 AD. We know about St. Benedict's life from a work of literature called the Dialogues. This was put together by Pope St. Gregory the Great. And he wrote about St. Benedict about 50 years after Benedict had died. So we think he's fairly close to the historical St. Benedict, while at the same time, because of the kind of writing that St. Gregory was doing, what they call hagiography, or the story of saints, there's a lot of sort of supernatural activity going on in Benedict's life. When we get into the supernatural activity, you know, we don't make a lot of historical claims about that. Whether this person performed this miracle at this time and place is not as important as that we see God working through that human being, that holy person. And so that's the purpose of the writings of St. Gregory the Great, as he speaks about the life of St. Benedict. One of the books that we have that is available here, if you want to read further about the details of St. Benedict's life, is this little book called The Life and Miracles of St. Benedict. This is a translation of the part of the Dialogues of Gregory the Great that refer to St. Benedict. So if you're interested, we have those here as well. It's fascinating. A lot of crazy things going on. A lot of really amazing things in St. Benedict's life. We know from the Dialogues that Benedict was born from a noble family, that his family sent him to study in Rome, and they wanted him to study law or literature or, you know, whatever the sort of the upper class was doing at that time. Benedict, however, was very, very disturbed by what he saw in the big city, and he considered the moral decadence there to be very dangerous for his soul. And so, at the ripe old age of 20, he left Rome and went to live in a small village some distance away. And shortly after that, he went off to live in complete solitude for 3 years up in the mountainous region of Subiaco. There he lived as a hermit, and his deepening relationship with God was manifested through the gift of performing miracles and prophecy, and also by God's constant protection. When he was in his hermitage, people began to come and visit him because they realized that this was a holy man. And because of the interest of other people in joining his way of life, Benedict formed about 12 small monasteries around the area of Subiaco. And then finally, he traveled about 50 miles further to the south, and he constructed the great monastery, which we now know as Monte Cassino. It was at Monte Cassino that St. Benedict wrote his famous rule for monks, and it was also at Monte Cassino that he died, somewhere around the year 547 A.D. As we look at the life of St. Benedict, it can be really hard sometimes to draw from that life examples that we can follow. This is a man who went off on his own at the age of 20 to become a hermit. You know, not a lot of 20-year-olds are thinking about becoming hermits, usually. And this is a man whose life was so absorbed in contemplation and in very hard work for the kingdom of God. There are points in his life, however, that I think we can look at as a guide to our own, even if we don't necessarily imitate, you know, all the details of what he did in his life. And these are the things I'd like to focus on if we look at St. Benedict's life. The first thing that we see in St. Benedict is that he had that tremendous single-mindedness, that tremendous focus on what was important in life. For Benedict, the most important thing was to get closer to God, and to get closer to God by specifically by doing God's will. Benedict understood that there were certain things that seemed important to human beings, and that those things were not always the most important thing to God. I like to compare St. Benedict in a certain way with people in the secular world that are highly motivated. You know, the ones that make sure they get into the right college or they go to the right training school to get exactly the kind of position that they want, to make a name for themselves, whether it's in law or medicine or some other kind of career. And they sacrifice a lot of things to do that. Well, St. Benedict, you know, he didn't have secular goals, but he definitely was clearly focused on the spiritual life. And he was willing to do whatever he needed to do in order to strengthen his relationship with God. That was his goal. That was his single-minded effort. Another aspect of St. Benedict's life that is worthy of imitation is the way that we see him sort of stepping away from certain elements of life, sort of getting away from the things that he found to be distracting in his search for God. Now, he did it, of course, at first by becoming a hermit, someone that lived in almost complete solitude. But all of us have the need from time to time to step away from the things that are not drawing us close to God. It normally doesn't mean that we have to isolate ourselves. But for instance, we may think about, say a high school student that decides to steer away from the snobbish little cliques in his or her school because they realize this is not guiding them to God. Maybe a young family man who stops going out to the bar after work so he can be home with his family. Maybe a professional woman or a man who turns away from temptations to lie and cheat in order to get ahead. We have to be willing to step back from the things that are not going to lead us in the direction that we want to go. And being able to walk away from those things is a great grace that St. Benedict really shows to us. But stepping away is not all there is. The other part of it is also reaching out. Reaching out. St. Benedict stepped away from the world as a hermit. But even as a hermit, people were coming to him and saying, "Teach us your way of life. Help us to understand how you have so much peace and how you have so much intimacy with God." And so Benedict understood from the people that were coming to visit him that God was now inviting him to reach out to other people. Not to keep the blessing of God's grace and God's support to himself, but to share that with others. And so these are three aspects of St. Benedict's life. His focus on the spiritual life, his decision to step away from the things that were a barrier to growing closer to God, and then his response to God's invitation to reach out to those who, like himself, were seeking God in their daily life. As I mentioned, by the time St. Benedict passed on, went home to God, he had already written his beautiful and influential rule for monks. And I'd like to spend the rest of this presentation just picking out a few elements of that rule, things that you're already familiar with, but at the same time, things that we continue to reflect on and draw strength from. Just as an overview of the rule, many of you already know this, but I'm just going to kind of review some of the structure of St. Benedict's rule. As you know, the rule was written for monastic communities. And so it has a lot of practical considerations about how you get a bunch of people to live together in a way that's more or less peaceful and supportive. But at the same time, there's a lot of spirituality in the rule. So that it is indirect in the way that St. Benedict teaches the people in his community to live together. And some of it is very direct. He enunciates certain spiritual principles directly in the rule. The rule starts out with the famous prologue, which is, as you know, several pages long. And it's really, in a certain sense, it's a spiritual pep talk. It's something that we can turn to maybe when we're feeling a little bit off course or a little bit down or not so sure what direction we're headed this day, this month, this year. It gives us that sense of God calling out to us and helps us to find within ourselves that desire to respond to God's call. to follow the way of Christ, to serve Him as our true Lord and King. In the beginning sections of the rule, Benedict talks about the importance of the abbot, the spiritual father of the community. He talks about the qualities that that person needs to have. And I think in our own lives, that chapter is important, not necessarily because we're all living in a monastic community and we have to know about what the abbot's about, but there are so many characteristics of the abbot that we can use in our own lives, especially when we're responsible for caring for other people. By the fourth chapter, St. Benedict is getting into his spiritual teaching. The fourth chapter is what we call the tools of good works. And these are just these little short, wise sayings about what goes into the spiritual life and what would not be compatible with the spiritual life. And the sayings are drawn all over the place from sacred scripture, and Benedict really puts them together in a very, very creative and helpful way. Benedict goes on to teach about obedience in chapter 5. And in chapter 7, he has the longest chapter of the rule dedicated to humility, the 12 steps of humility. So that's a lot of his spiritual teaching is found in those first few chapters of the rule. And then toward the end of the rule, we begin to find a few other spiritual teachings, especially in the last few chapters, the teaching about mutual obedience and the good zeal of monks. And in between, the chapters from chapter 8 on into the 60s, Benedict is talking about the structure of community life. He spends a lot of time talking about the liturgy of the hours, morning prayer, evening prayer, night prayer, and all the hours that the monks gather to pray. And that just tells us how important that is to the life of the monastery. And for Oblates of St. Benedict, that tells us how important it is to try to find a way to include the liturgy in our own daily lives. Because it is not only the prayer of the monks, but it's also the prayer of the church and the prayer of Jesus. And after many chapters of describing exactly how the Divine Office should be prayed, St. Benedict says, above all else, we urge that if anyone finds this distribution of the Psalms unsatisfactory, he should arrange them whatever, we should arrange whatever he judges better. So again, there's a certain flexibility in that. I'm not going to go through too much else in terms of exactly what is in the rule. I know that most of you have been through the rule at various points. During the novitiate, I always ask that you read a small section of the rule every day, at least three sentences. And since it's impossible just to read three sentences, as you notice, you end up getting through the rule pretty much during the course of the day. So you become, I think, many of you have become quite familiar with the structure of St. Benedict's rule. I'm just going to highlight a few points from the rule that I really have always considered central points to Benedict's teaching. As you know, the rule begins with that passage from the prologue that says, "Listen. Listen carefully, my son, to the Master's instructions and attend to them with the ear of your heart. This is advice from a father who loves you. Welcome it and faithfully put it into practice. And it's no accident that the rule begins with that word, listen. Because listening is a central part of the whole spirituality of Saint Benedict. And I think it's especially an important thing for us in the 21st century to hear that reminder. Because, after all, we get so much input during our day. We get so many words, so many images, so much noise. We all know people that have to have a radio on in every room all day long because they've gotten used to having that input. And yet, if the input is just background noise, what is the meaning of it? St. Benedict says we actually need to listen. We need to open our ears and open our hearts. And part of that listening starts just with breaking off some of that outer noise and also trying to calm down the inner noise as well. Many of you know that one of the chief characteristics of a monastery is that we have bells. Our bell right now is in need of serious help. But the more help we've gotten, the worse it's got. So I'm not sure what's going to happen next. But if you haven't heard our bell for a while, stay tuned.
It didn't stop, did it?
It stopped. Well, it went crazy first.
I know. Yes.
Well, it was electrified a couple of years ago, and one morning they pushed the button for it to ring, and it wouldn't stop. It was like a fire alarm bell. Bing, 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 bing. And it was crazy. I was on the tower when it fell over. But since then, we've decided that it needs help. That's all. So, but it is important, so that's why we're not giving up. The bell is, in Latin, it was called in the monastic tradition, the Vox Dei, which means the voice of God. This is like God speaking to us, saying, wake up, pay attention, it's time to listen. Set aside what you're working on, turn the radio or the television off, and just be quiet and listen, because I've got something to say to you. I've got something to say. And we find God's voice speaking to us when we're willing to listen to it in so many different ways. We have in the monastic tradition, as you know, the whole practice of Lectio Divina, which of course in Latin it simply means sacred reading. And Lectio Divina is really just that taking that time to pause and listen to the voice of God. Often we do Lectio Divina by sitting down and taking out a passage from Scripture and reading it slowly and trying to listen for what God is saying to us in that passage. Winnie a few months ago gave us a wonderful explanation of Lectio Divina. And we had that other, Mary McKean, who came the previous year and led us through an exercise of using our imaginations to place ourselves in a gospel story and let Jesus speak to us what we need to hear. And Lectio Divina comes in that way and in other ways as well. I mean, sometimes we sit down and we just reflect on our day. You know, what is our life like right now? And what, in reflecting on reading the book of our own lives, sometimes that elicits a prayer of gratitude to God for his blessings, maybe a prayer of help, you know. Sometimes it can be anything. The book of nature is also a beautiful place to listen to the voice of God, especially on days like this. You know, one of these days we should have our class outside. Yes. It just occurred to me.
I used to walk around where you saw those people walking. And around that corner, it's beautiful. beautiful. And that's where nobody ever goes. The forsythia are out.
Oh, the flowers.
The bush? Uh-huh. That bush by the...
The yellow bush, uh-huh.
Forsythia. I thought that was like pussy willows or something.
It's like
that. It's called a forsythia.
They call it the spring. But it's beautiful and it's hidden.
Yeah, it is. It's right outside Father Dan's window.
Oh.
A couple... I don't know if you got it somewhere, right? But a couple days ago, I was walking by that bush, and I was not right next to the bush. I was a few yards away, and I heard this humming noise. And I said, my gosh, there must be a huge wasp nest here somewhere. And so naturally, I went looking for it. Not like it's done, right? It's a different version of St. Benedict's penances. So I'm looking for, where's that wasp nest? Where is it, you know? And this is Alexia Divina, in a way. I looked and I got closer and I heard the buzzing. And I looked at that forsythia bush. And there were hundreds of bees, little honeybees, just going from one little blossom to another, you know. And I thought, bees must really enjoy spring. You know, I mean, because this is like, yeah, the flowers are out again. We get to go around and get all this...
Get some sugar.
So, I mean, there was something in that. I just thought that was beautiful. And, you know, if I had just, you know, if I was going out for a jog, you know, and if I had put, you know, earphones in my ears, you know, on my jog, I wouldn't have heard these bees, and I wouldn't have had that experience of seeing them, you know, so busy and excited about, you know, the spring flowers. So, Lexio Divina can, and God's voice, it can get you just about anywhere. Just about anywhere. If we're listening. Another aspect of the rule, as you know, that's really important is the whole balance between prayer and work. The part that prayer plays in our lives, and then sort of the corresponding part that work plays in our lives. And St. Benedict very much emphasized this. I'm going to read a passage from chapter 48. I love this passage because it's like, this passage reads like a day in the life of a monk. But keep in mind, these are monks from the 5th and 6th century. It's not exactly this way. But it's not that different. This is the passage that's actually titled The Daily Manual Labor. But I want you to notice how much labor and prayer, work and prayer, it's all interspersed. It's all interspersed. Idleness is the enemy of the soul. Therefore, the brothers should have specified periods for manual labor as well as for prayerful reading. We believe that the times for both may be arranged as follows. From Easter to the 1st of October, they will spend their mornings after 7 until 10 at whatever work needs to be done. 3 hours of work. From 10 until midday prayer, they will devote themselves to reading. 2 hours of reading. After midday prayer and their meal, they may rest on their beds in complete silence. Nap time. Should a brother wish to read privately, let him do so, but without disturbing the others. They should pray the mid-afternoon hour a little early, about 2:30, and then until evening prayer they are to return to whatever work is necessary. They must not become distressed if local conditions or their poverty should force them to do the harvesting themselves. When they live by the labor of their hands, as our fathers and the apostles did, then they are really monks. So you see this balance, this time to work, time to pray, and the two things are interspersed. And therefore, the two things are part of the holiness of our lives. They're part of how we go to God. You know that in our monastery, we have our own schedule of prayer. We have our morning prayers at 6 in the morning,
or seven, depending on the day. We have some time after that for Lectio Divina. Then we have the celebration of the Eucharist. And then we have the morning for work. Nowadays, most monasteries don't interrupt morning work with prayer. In other words, we have larger blocks of time for work rather than shorter blocks of time. I think that just the nature of how things have developed, the nature of the work that we do, sometimes it would be very difficult to gather everyone back together again in the middle of the morning or the middle of the afternoon. And I think most people's lives are that way. I mean, most people won't be sitting at their desk and, oh, it's 10 o'clock, I think I'll go and pray. You know, they're probably in the middle of doing something else. But we break at 10 minutes before lunch for our midday prayer here. And then after lunch, we do have a short rest period if someone needs to rest. I usually find myself needing to rest, which is not something that started when I entered the monastery. I remember when I was working in accounting, I would sit at my desk. I would usually have lunch at my desk, and I would eat in 10 minutes. And then I would sit at my desk the rest of the 20 minutes of the half-hour lunch. And I'd have my working papers here. So even then I was practicing the rule of St. Benedict. I just didn't know it. And the funniest thing is that one of my co-workers one time came around. She was just a sweet lady. But she came around to my wonderful, beautiful cubicle. And she peeped her head around. It was just about that time. And I was studying. And she said, oh, she said, I don't want to disturb you while you're napping. She napped. So I was fooling no one. But anyway, so prayer, work, and rest. I want to read to you a little passage from the book Benedict's Way. This is Father. These are Father Dan's words, and he describes a monk who is deceased now, died in 1992, but who made a great impression on Father Dan, and I'm sure on the rest of the brothers in the community, because of his, specifically because of his spirituality of work and how that work made him, helped to make him a holy man. Father Dan describes Brother Albrecht, and he says that Brother Albrecht discovered he had cancer only a few months before the illness ended his life at age 98. Brother Ben, by the way, is 95 now. So he's in competition with Brother Albrecht. The hard news did not change Brother Albrecht's life very much. He did not stop working until 2 months before his death. Brother Albrecht continued to cook for his brother monks. He gardened, mowed the lawn, and joyfully served the community. I remember when I went to visit him during the last days of his illness. Brother Albrecht was living in Detroit. Father Dan was up here in Oxford, so he went down to visit him. His face came alive. His smile reached his eyes, and he said, "Danny, you came all the way to see me." He made me feel as if I had handed him the hidden treasure of Atlantis. Brother Albrecht's work shaped him into a man of prayer, a man who was good and loving his brother monks. Think about that. In the hours spent pushing a lawnmower, stirring soup, shoveling snow, polishing a table, pulling weeds, Albrecht was being worked on by God. We are too. Work turns us outward, lifts our heads, straightens our shoulders, and extends our hands to others. It takes discipline and determination to tackle work with a spirit like Brother Albrecht's. But as we are faithful to our work, we are faithful to all the lives we touch, and we are faithful to a vivid, holy vision of ourselves. And I think that really describes the whole meaning of the Benedictine way of life as it concerns that interplay between work and prayer. And the way that the work that we do, whatever it may be, it becomes really the place where God is inviting us to do His will on that day. The last topic I want to touch briefly on from Benedict's Rule is the very well-known topic of Benedictine hospitality. And we can't really talk about the Rule of Benedict without speaking about hospitality, as you know. At the time of St. Benedict, hospitality meant being available as a place for travelers to stop. For travelers to stop and get a meal, get a place to rest. It was in the days, of course, before we had all these motels and hotels popping up along the roadside, before we had those wonderful service plazas on the freeway where you can get your coffee, your food, you know, gas up your car and you're on the way. Monasteries were very prominent. They were prominent places for travelers at this time. And St. Benedict instructed his monks that whenever visitors came around, they should welcome them as they would welcome Christ. In fact, St. Benedict reminds them of what Jesus himself says in the Gospel, "I was a stranger and you welcomed me." And so, in the visit of these travelers, these guests, the monks would come to see Jesus himself, their God, coming in the flesh. And they learned to respect and to show love to this person who they saw as Christ presenting himself to them in very human, in the very real and human needs of the traveler. Of course, nowadays, even monasteries don't have as many guests as they used to. Most people, when they're on vacation, don't stay at monasteries, but some do. But the point, I think, is that we find other ways to welcome people in our lives. We find other situations. There are many, many guests and strangers that Benedict invites us to look upon as we would see, and see Christ in them. Who are these people? The stranger, the guest, can really be anyone. It can be the person we meet by chance. It can be someone that we minister to. It can be someone who moves in down the street. The stranger can even be someone that we live with, or someone we work with, someone we've known all our lives. Any human being that we have yet to fully discover, any human being whose presence calls us more and more out of ourselves. One of the gifts of community life as well as family life is the gift of living with other people. And in living with other people, there's a tremendous spiritual benefit to that. We had an older monk, a very wise monk from Sri Lanka. His name was Father Thomas. And he taught us when we were novices. This would have been back in the mid-1990s. Father Thomas was from the island country of Sri Lanka. And he had so many examples of things that we would not necessarily think of here in the States. One of his examples of the benefit of community life was that he talked about how it would be if you had a couple of very, very sharp, hard stones, and you tried to hold them in your hands, they would be very rough and unpleasant. And if you took these stones and set them up on a shelf, apart from each other, they would always more or less stay that way. They'd be rough, they'd be hard, they'd be unpleasant. But if you take those same stones, he would say, and put them in the riverbed, you know, I don't know where we find a riverbed here, but I mean, he had that experience. Put them in the riverbed and let them get jostled about and let them get bumped up against each other and see what happens to those stones over time. They lose their sharpness. They lose their unpleasantness. They become smooth and they become softer and more gentle. And in a certain sense, that's an aspect of hospitality. As our hearts, which may at times have little sharp edges to them, bump up against the hearts of other people, they can become smoothed out and polished through that daily contact with one another. It's when we really allow other human beings into our lives and into our hearts, when we allow them to touch us, sometimes to inconvenience us, when we allow them to love us, allow them to hate us, our hearts begin to open and stretch, and we are able more and more to embrace our own humanity and that of others. A couple of points that St. Benedict offers us in terms of growing in the practice of hospitality are as follows. One thing that can help to make us more hospitable is this whole practice of listening. As we listen to the voice of God in Scripture, in the events of our lives, in nature, we also need to practice the art of listening with one another as well. When we actually listen to what other people are saying to us with an attentive heart, then we allow them to tell their story. In allowing them to tell their story, we discover their humanity and we become more in touch with Jesus, the God who became human. And another point that St. Benedict would tell us by way of becoming more hospitable is that we need to sort of prioritize in our lives. We need to sort of simplify. That many times our days are filled with things that maybe are not as important. We sometimes spend time doing things we know that are not really necessarily at the core of life. If we can tie up some loose ends, and I know it's very hard sometimes, but if we can tie up some loose ends so we're not always rushing from one moment to the next, then sometimes we can make a little bit more space in our lives. And we may find ourselves more willing and able to welcome that guest, to listen to that person who needs us to listen, when that person arrives to make their legitimate claim on our time. And these are just a couple of lessons that I think Benedict gives us that help us to see the possibilities of hospitality in our lives, and to see the great value that it can have as we begin more and more to recognize Christ in one another. In this short little overview, which went a little bit longer than I thought it would, I hope that it serves just as a kind of revisiting for some of you, and maybe as a source of new information for many of you that are new. I've always found that Benedict's teachings are so relevant to life. They survive through the centuries because essentially they draw their life from the gospel. And the gospel is that universal, timeless message of salvation. And so as the teachings of Benedict, his teaching on listening, his teaching on prayer and work, his understanding of hospitality, as all of these teachings are presented to us, and as we try to apply them in our lives, may they continue to lead us along the gospel path. And as we are led on that path, may the Lord truly bring us all together to life everlasting. Amen. I have a few things to pass out.
After this quarter after the